Star Tide Rising, Cassette 7.
Chapter 45. Tom Worley. A chilly sea breeze swept over him out of the west. A bout of shivering shook him awake in the middle of the night, his eyes open in the dark, staring into emptiness. He couldn't remember where he was. Give it a moment, he thought. It'll come. He had been dreaming of the planet Garth, where the seas were small and the rivers many. There he had lived for a time among the human and chimp colonists, a mixed colony as rich and surprising as Calathea, where man and dolphin dwelt together. Garth was a friendly world, though isolated far from other Earthling settlements. In his dream, Garth was invaded. Giant warships hovered over her cities and spewed clouds of gas across her fertile valleys, sending colonists fleeing in panic. The sky had been filled with flashing lights. He had trouble separating the trailing edges of the dream from reality. Tom stared at the crystal dome of Kithrop's night. His body was locked, legs pulled in, hands clutching opposite shoulders, as much from a rigor of exhaustion as from the cold. Slowly he got the muscles to loosen. Tendons popped and joints groaned as he learned all over again how to move. The volcano to the north had died down to only a feeble red glow. There were long, ragged openings in the clouds overhead. Tom watched pinpoints of light in the sky. He thought about stars. Astronomy was his mental focus. Red means cool, he pondered. That red one there might be a small nearby ancient or a distant giant already in its death throes. And that bright one over there could be a blue supergiant, very rare. Was there one in this area of space? He ought to remember. Tom blinked. The blue star was moving. He watched it drift across the starfield until it intercepted another bright pinpoint, this one a brilliant green. There was a flash as the two tiny lights met. When the blue spark moved on, the green was no more. Now what were the chances I'd witness that? How likely to be looking at just the right place at the right time? The battle must still be pretty hot and heavy up there. It isn't over yet. Tom tried to rise, but his body sagged back against the bed of vines. Okay, try again. He rolled over onto one elbow, paused to marshal his strength, then pushed upright. Kithrop's small, dim moons were absent, but there was enough starlight to make out the eerie weedscape. Water sluiced through the shifting morass. There were croaking and slithering sounds. Once he heard a tiny scream that choked off. Some small prey suddenly dying, he supposed. He was thankful for the obstinacy that had brought him to this modest height. Even 2 meters made a difference. He couldn't have survived a night down in that loathsome mess. He turned stiffly and began groping through his meager supplies on the crude sledge. First priority was to get warm. He pulled the top piece of his wetsuit from the jumbled pile and gingerly slid into it. Tom knew he should give some attention to his wounds, but they could wait just a little longer. So could a full meal. He had salvaged enough stores for a few of those. Munching on a food bar and taking sparing sips from a canteen, Tom appraised his small pile of equipment. At the moment, what mattered were his 3 psi bombs. He looked up at the sky. Except for a faint purple haze near 1 bright star, there were no more signs of the battle. Yet that 1 glimpse had been enough. Tom already knew which bomb to set off. Jillian had spent a few hours with the NIS machine before leaving Streaker to meet him at Toshio's Island. She had connected the Timbrimi device to the Thenanin microbranch library he had salvaged. Then she and the NIS had worked out the proper signals to load into the bombs. The most important was the Thenanin distress call. Ifni's fickle luck permitting, it would let Tom perform the crucial experiment to find out if the plan would work. All of the work Suessi and Tisht and the others had put into the Trojan seahorse would come to naught if Thenanin were not amongst those left in the war. What use would it be for Streaker to slip inside a hollowed-out Thenanin hulk, to rise into space in disguise, if all the combatants would shoot anyway at a remnant of a faction which had already lost? Tom picked up one psi-bomb. It was spherical and rested in his hand like an orb. At the top was a safety switch and timer. Jillian had carefully labeled each bomb on a strip of tape. On this one she had added a flowing signature and a small heart with an arrow through it. Tom smiled and brought the bomb to his lips. He had felt guilty of machismo, insisting on being the one to come here while she remained behind. Now he knew he had been right. Tough and competent as Jillian was, she wasn't as good a pilot as he, and probably would have died in the crash. She certainly wouldn't have had the physical strength to haul the sledge this far. L, he thought. I'm glad because she's safe with friends who'll protect her. That's reason enough. She may be able to lick 10 Blenchuk cave lizards with one hand tied, but she's my lady, and I'll not let harm come near her if I can help it. The complaining volcano thundered and rumbled, reminding him ironically of Mount Diana, when he had last seen it, spilling molten magma down the towering, shelving slope of Aphrodite Terra, that continent whose flanks were washed by the searing, bone-dry ghost of a primeval Dead Sea. Under the sulphurous clouds of Venus, those lava flickerings had illuminated another long night of all too well-remembered pain, only this nearby Kithrupan fumarole would have barely glimmered on mighty Diana's distant fiery shoulders. Anyway, on Venus, night has no end. There, too, he had lain amid rubble, half broken, wondering whether he was going to live or die. Through his pitted helmet visor, he had watched infrared trails through the choking atmosphere left by a slow rain of faraway descending comets, hurtling ice balls whose targeted plummet seemed aimed just over the curved horizon, beyond the reach of sight or sound. He had been young and naive then, or else he never would have trusted a stranger's word that the hired dirigiplane was fully checked out for a quick dash across Ella's burning sands, a stranger who, Tom later recalled, had never once looked him in the eye while filling out the rental forms. First impressions can be wrong, he contemplated, after barely surviving the crash, but when in doubt, trust what your senses tell you. Then, too, the overwhelming sensation had been of frustration and failure. With information in his pouch, the Venus terraforming project might yet manage to hold on to its alien advisors, galactics from the Institute for Progress, who were due to pull out the very next day, dismissing as quixotic the quaint human dream of awakening seas already dead for 3 billion years. With their knowledge and technological aid, miracles might yet happen if only the advisors could be persuaded to stay. If the data reached them in time... He shuddered, remembering that earlier trial. The similarities were deceiving. On Venus, help had been just an hour away, and the issues, while serious, weren't as horrific. And on Venus the problem was to keep from burning up. A chill breeze penetrated his damp clothes, sending his teeth briefly chattering. Still, from now on, maybe I'd better make a point of staying away from volcanoes. Tom washed down the last of the protein bar. He hefted the bomb and considered strategy. His original plan had been to land near the volcano, wait until the glider had recharged for launching, then plant the bomb and take flight before it went off. He could have ridden thermals from the volcano to a good altitude and found another island from which to watch the results of his experiment.